The Legally Brief podcast is produced by the law offices of Judy Saunders.
Hello. I am so excited to have this conversation with Georgina Ryan. Gina Ryan, I'm a huge fan, and I know that listeners will get lots of interesting ways to manage, to discuss, to think about, to approach the whole realm, the whole understanding and managing anxiety. So let's dive right in. Can you tell us a little bit about how you came to the work, this work as an anxiety coach? Tell us a little bit about your background. What inspired this?
Sure, Judy. Thanks. First off, thanks for having me. This is wonderful. I follow your work also, and I'm excited with what you are doing in the world. It's important. So I got started, I had anxiety as late teen, like adult teen, like 19. I went through much of my life, right? You know, just plugging along, because this was back in the 70s. So nobody was really talking about this. They would say you had the nerves, or you were sensitive or whatever, but nobody used the word anxiety, and they certainly didn't have anything really helpful for you. So I remember just plugging along and having to do a lot of reading. I'm kind of a person who likes to research things and find out the reasons for things. So I did a lot of my own research. And so over the years, I found things that worked, things that didn't work. I was a nutritionist. I owned natural product stores in New York. And I was also the wellness consultant at a spa. So I saw a lot of people. I did a lot of work. I said, geez, a lot of people, you know, have the same struggles. They're talking about things that I suffer inside. Of course, I wasn't telling them about it, right? Anxiety, that's one of its little things, is we keep it inside ourselves, right? So, I have a big life change in New York, and I come to Maui in Hawaii, and I, instead of opening up stores or trying to work at a spa, I worked at eating disorder centers, right, with the women, mostly women. Occasionally we had a man, an outpatient, but at both the residential center and the intensive outpatient, with these women who were struggling with eating disorders. And what we found is that they actually related to me quite a lot. And the therapist used to say to me, I don't know why they like you so much. They usually don't like the dietitian or the nutritionist. And I, over time, Judy, realized that I didn't relate to them on an eating disorder level because I never had that struggle. But I related to them on the anxiety level, because underneath their eating disorder was anxiety. It's almost like it is the root of so many different issues and problems that people suffer with. So I did that for 12 years here on Maui. And then I had been always interviewed on a lot of different shows, a podcast, and different kind of radio things. And then I got the opportunity to continue on with the Anxiety Coaches podcast. And then they asked me if I would take the reins. So it became my full-time gig eventually. I very slowly titrated out of eating disorders, in-person clients, and see everybody now on the phone, or Zoom, and just try to share everything for free for everybody on the podcast, because people feel very alone with anxiety. So that's how we kind of got here.
Well, you have hit on two very important points. And I do see that a common thread among humans of the connecting through the anxiety, which to me, I can personalize this, was a portal. Becoming aware of the anxiety was a portal, and it was an awareness. And I know that that's one of the things that I want us to focus about. I know that you've personally helped me manage, understand, and become aware of that anxiety and putting that name on it. So you had said that when you were first becoming aware of it, you know, in the 70s and seeing it show up in your own life, there wasn't the language around it. And the one thing, it's not that anxiety, I think, is becoming any better or any more managed, but I'm finding that we're at least getting some language and calling it what it is. Is that what you've seen happen over the years of your practice?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There was no language for it in the past. And I know this has been going on for hundreds of years. People have had this struggle of getting stuck in that loop that we talk about, the fear anxiety loop. And they get, but we never had language in for it. Like they'd come up with diseases or treat you for other things, or best they could offer women, you know, back in my day was sleeping pills, you know, or mother's little helpers, or, right. You know. So yes, now we have a language for it. And that is true of all medicine and science, right? Every day, Judy, we learn something new. I learn something new every single day about anxiety and the brain and the body connection. Yeah.
So I remember when I was a young attorney just starting out, and I was working with children in the Crimes Against Children unit as a prosecutor in Brooklyn, New York. And I can remember before I had any awareness as to what anxiety was, I had seen it come up, the sheer terror and fear being very new to this field, practicing attorney, the weight and the magnitude of the work, and now helping dealing with children who had suffered, you know, sexual abuse, physical abuse, neglect. And it makes me think, as you talk about getting a language understanding, it makes me think of a case that I had worked on where three little kids, and they were not born here in America, but they were living in Brooklyn. So they had migrated here, and it was an uncle who the allegations were had sexually abused them. And I just remember having to find ways to communicate. And there was some success in that communicating, but it takes me back to that early when I was learning the language and understanding this, the fear that the children I saw on their face, their bodies, the instantaneous crying, you know, the big tears. What are some of the symptoms that you've seen, some of the iterations? How does anxiety show up in children or young people and even teens? What have you seen?
Yes, it comes out in a lot of different ways individually, depending on the person's personality, right? It can come out, as you are talking about, in big tears, in big emotional states. But it can also come out in anger, in lashing out, in acting out, wanting control. So a lot of different ritualistic kind of behaviors with children, even with their toys or how they play. I think play therapy can be really helpful with children if they're dealing with anxiety. And more up into the teens, again, it can become withdrawn. Can withdraw from those who would help them, meaning parents or friends. There's this withdrawal because there's this sense of embarrassment about it as they get older. But a lot of physical symptoms too. Bellyache, the big one is the stomach ache. Many parents reporting to me the kids that don't want to go to school because their stomach hurts. Difficulty sleeping, nightmares. Those type of things that the parent would be picking up on at home. Okay. And again, having come from eating disorders, controlling food. Because what happens when we have anxiety is we don't feel like we have any control over the thing that is scaring us the most. And so we control other things in our life that we can control. And it can come down to food, right?
You know why, Gina? So I'd love to dive into that about the eating disorders and the control and the food. And I want to take us in two directions, but first, in one direction, I'd love to talk about your experience with the eating disorders. So a lot of our listeners will have been going through the experience as competitive athletes, at some point in their lives. And we can only imagine that part of that being competitive, being at the top of your game, so to speak, requires you know, the conditioning of the body, the eating, the food. What can you tell some of the listeners who are having struggles with food because they live in the world of competitive youth sports?
Yeah, what a great question, because it gets confusing, right? What, you know, I'm being instructed to eat XYZ in that manner, and I'm doing it, but it could be changing the person, or they may take it to the extreme, right? Well, they said XYZ, so I'm going to do twice this, that right. prescription, right? Because if one is good, two is better, which is not always true. Or if, you know, or going the other way, less and less, right? Because we want to be more muscular or toned and not have any of that God forbidden fat on our bodies. So what happens is that becomes ingrained, and it becomes enmeshed with the anxiety, because there's some sense of relief from control. If you want it, from the control of the food. Oh, wow, look how good I am. Right. Look how good I am. It becomes moral. I am such a wonderful person because I can do this. Not everybody can do this. And then it can go to the extreme where that's not good enough anymore. Now I need to actually get that food out of me, whether that means exercising or purging in other ways, physical ways, but just not wanting to keep the food in me because, again, if X is good, I can go even lower, and that would be even better. Because it's not, it starts out in a harmful way. It starts out, but the stress and the anxiety and the feeling of control with the food makes the anxiety go away for a moment, whether it's exercising, whether it's counting calories, whatever it is, it makes the person have that sense of relief for a moment. Mm-hmm. And so they want that, and they seek it over and over, and then it becomes a habit, and then it becomes dangerous. But the person still believes that they are doing the right thing.
Right.
And so that's where it can be hard to pull them back, because they really believe they're doing the right and good thing.
And then, you know, if you can touch on, if you can think of any, you know, management, any tools or skills, because speaking in under this scenario, because if you have a teen, if you have a young person that is in this highly competitive sport, and if you have a scenario where the coach is using food, maybe, you know, not under the guidance of someone that has a nutritional background, and then food may become a tool to either shame the athlete or to exacerbate that anxiety, what would you say to the parents or that young person on how to look at food, how to not let it exacerbate any underlying anxiety, or just, or how to piece it out, how to take it apart so that food doesn't get enmeshed in this bigger anxiety issue?
Yeah, very good. That's the where we have to remember that we are not just our thinking minds, and our bodies are not just built for the physical athletic events. These things are very connected, and we need to spend time doing that. Mm-hmm. And I mean that with food, connecting to the hunger level again. The athletes that I've had cyclists, and they are, I was shocked how they could be so athletic and strong and eat such little food. Mm. It's very real, but they got in the groove, and the body is so forgiving, it will go a long time before it starts to shut down. But the point being that they have to be able to connect their awareness with the body, and that means their hunger. Hunger, because food is used often by the coaches, as you say, or in other manners, it's either used as a punishment or a reward even sometimes. So food becomes this piece that can be moved back and forth with them. They have to stay true to their own body and mind, meaning taking the mind with the awareness and bringing it down to, how does my body feel? Am I hungry? When I eat this prescriptive way, do I feel satisfied? Because many athletes eat very to satiation all the time, and they are still able to do what they need to do and are eating, you know, within what their body needs to stay in that muscular tone. They don't need to be starved, and they don't need to have the food continually used in that way. They need to stay in touch. So again, it's that connecting the mind and the body. Where is my hunger? When do I know to eat? Do I eat by the clock, or do I eat when I'm hungry? What happens if I'm hungry in between? You know, because they don't think to ask the coach or whoever is prescribing their dietary needs. What do I do if I'm hungry in between? Or so ask questions. It's your body.
Right.
You have to take ownership of that body. You know, even with a parent that's trying to guide them with the food, say they have to learn their own hunger level. Like, we want to stay between 5 and 6, with 0 being flat on the floor in starvation and 10 being Thanksgiving stuff, right?
Right.
We want to stay around 5 or 6. But when we get to 3, we should eat.
Right, right.
We should eat. And so what happens is they lose touch with it. Right?
And I think that's, if I'm hearing you correctly, it is, and I know that part of what I've learned from you, from reading and from listening to your podcast, it's returning your body, returning your mind back to its natural state. It sounds like that's what you're saying. Mm-hmm. When you have an athlete, a child, whomever, you know, a survivor of abuse, and if there mm-hmm. is an issue with anxiety, and if it manifests itself either with eating or some type mm-hmm. of other way, it's returning and getting in touch back with yourself. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Absolutely. Because if we don't explore that, we don't know when we're in it or out of it. Right. And, you know, we have those two wings of our nervous system, the parasympathetic nervous system, which is our rest and digest, being calm, and where all the repair in our body takes place. This is very important for athletes. That's where repair happens. And then we have fight or flight, which is the sympathetic nervous system, side of the nervous system. Now, we need both. There's no good guy, bad guy. But what happens with anxiety is we forget how to fall back into our natural parasympathetic nervous system. And we stay locked into that stress, fight or flight.
Right, right.
And then, so what happens, we just have to learn how to go back and forth, right? Back and forth.
Mm-hmm. I love that. I want to turn us a little in a different direction, and I want to try to offer some understanding to everyone about the concepts around the terms that we use. Oh, you're too sensitive, mm-hmm. for an individual that may be exhibiting anxiety, or you're frail, or you know, how we use, in my opinion, it would seem like this is just another way to blame. I'll give you a scenario. If you have a child that's involved in some level of sport, some level of play, or even a non-sport activity, if that child shows some type of, you know, high emotion or awareness or anxiety, in your experience, is it only sensitive individuals that become anxious or suffer from anxiety?
No, not in the least. Not in the least. As a matter of fact, if you could be a fly on the wall and hear the people that I talk to, I mean, we're talking about, like I said, I've had high athletes, we've had CEOs, I have doctors, lawyers,
right.
You know, teachers, teenagers, the whole, it runs the gamut. These are very strong. And often I get also a lot of engineers. Like, there's these are people who have drive, they're strong, they are intelligent, they can move mountains in the world. Mm. But inside, if I could say anything to your listeners, it would be to let go of the embarrassment. This isn't about being overly sensitive. Yes, sensitive people become anxious too, but not every sensitive person is anxious, right? I've had attorneys, I have a lot of you attorneys, I don't know why, and that have, you know, are the type that go around the world with their their work, and they're making all these massive changes in the world.
Right.
And then they're melting. They are a wreck.
Right.
Because inside they are holding on, because they have forgotten how to find their way back to their parasympathetic nervous system to let it. It's a chemical reaction that happens in our body.
Right.
And if we can't turn it back on again, we can't access it.
And that's what we're going to do. We're going to end with, I cannot end without you giving some of your amazing tips. So I want people to be prepared, grab their pen and paper, because that's what we're going to end with. But talk a little bit about, I know, you know, in my experience, when I was managing and still manage anxiety, and if I had seen it manifested with close friends or family members, you know, within the home, my first thought was either my panic was setting off theirs and we would go in this vicious cycle, whomever it was. So how can you talk a little bit about how a parent can first support their child, support their athlete when that child is exhibiting panic in any of its forms? What are some things that a parent can do?
Yeah, the first thing a parent can do is to remain calm, which is probably the hardest piece, but just to hold their own center. So, you know, sometimes we get caught in that cycle you're talking about, each triggering each other's. It happens all the time, happens to me. But if you can back out and get yourself calm, even if that means you just have to take a trip to the bathroom, keep yourself calm, because the child will feed off of that, that youngster, right? And so they are looking to you for that support right then. So, but what will help the parents stay calm is to know that your child is okay. This is a scary thing to them and they feel really worked up inside. And you just have to be there to being, holding them is good if they are the type that would like that. Being able to move, you know, let them verbalize if they want to, but also help them to go and do something else. Maybe go for a walk together. To be able to bring that kind of energy down a little bit, because it feeds on itself. Mm. Not only will you feed it with each other, it will feed on itself. And it just gets bigger and bigger. And so being able to just remove, maybe you mean just move into a different room in the house, but being with them and letting them know that it's okay to talk about it, that you think it's perfectly fine. You're not worked up about it. You're not worried about it. That you can see that this happens to other people, and reassure them that they can handle it, that these are strong feelings, but they don't last forever. Very important that they learn that. And one of the ways I like to have kids visualize it is like waves in the ocean. Like a big wave will come, but then what? The water goes right back out again. And it'll come again, but we have to learn. That's, again, the both sides of the nervous system, letting it go back out again. And then teach them how to breathe.
I'm so excited by what you're saying, because it's so important. Because especially I'm thinking about even parents or loved ones that are new to the whole parenting, the parenting relationship. The first time you have a child that experiences a panic attack, it can be terrifying. So one, is it okay to let your child feel the anxiety? Should you stop it? Should you control it? If it's happening in public, that's one thing. So is it okay? And can you talk about maybe what are some of the stages? What's a really bad anxiety symptoms or panic attack? What does that look like? What can it look like?
First of all, it's important that they do have permission to feel it and to go through it, because we can't stop it. Mm. They can't stop it inside. So if they feel that you're freaking out, they'll think, oh my God, now I'm hurting them. And so that makes it even worse inside of them.
Okay.
That you let them know they just have to ride this wave. It won't last forever. And so what can that wave look like? Because it's going to come up and it's going to come right back down again. But it takes time. And one of the first things that can help that turn into where it's coming down is for them to feel safe. Okay. So you have to let them know you're safe. It's very important that they hear that you're safe.
Okay.
It's okay. I'm here. It's okay. It feels uncomfortable now, but it will go away. I know this because that's what anxiety does. And let them know that the symptoms and sensations that they're feeling, they can describe them to you, or that might be helpful for them. They could be feeling their heart racing. They could be feeling their stomach churning. They could be feeling like they had 10 cups of coffee. Like, that's really what it feels like. And if the parent can understand that what has happened in the child is their body has released stress hormones, and these hormones make them feel like that for a very particular reason. There's nothing wrong with them. The body is just doing what it thought you wanted because of the scary thought made the body release all those stress hormones. And those stress hormones give you the ability to be able to run, right? Or to fight, to be strong. So it shunts the energy away from digestion, away from reproduction. They won't need those things if you're running from a tiger. You need all the strength you have to run. So your heart is beating fast, your lungs, you're breathing differently. Like, they might be almost panting because they're breathing from the upper part of their lung.
Mm-hmm.
The parent can remind them that this is exactly what the body does when it feels stressed. It's doing its job. It helps the kid not feel weird or something deathly wrong with me, and that it always ends. And in animals and in humans, mammals, I should say, so as we register safety, it's about 90 seconds before the body will stop producing those stress hormones and you'll actually be on your way out of it. But what happens is we don't get to safety. We keep telling ourselves in our mind, there's something wrong with me. Oh no, what does this mean? And blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
We keep going on. We never get to safety, so we can't come out of it.
That is so important. So
get them to safety. Yes.
So I'm hearing from you, one, anxiety is real. It happens. Mm-hmm. It looks mm-hmm. different. It can be in varying degrees, and it's okay. It's okay that it's happening, and you should let the child, whomever, the athlete, do it. Let them know they're safe, and you yourself don't panic. So with that, here's my question. Can you speak for a moment? So we talked about parents and a child relationship, that they have that close relationship. The parent is able to, you know, follow the child's lead, maybe let the child go through that 90 second. But what if you have, you're in a coaching situation, if we can try to imagine that scenario, and you see one of your athletes exhibiting some signs of anxiety, what would you say that you do in that type of more sterile environment, be it in a gym or on a field of play? What are some things that a coach can do that wants to support the athlete through this panic and anxiety?
It's different for the coach because there are different boundaries, right? So like I said before about holding somebody, that might not be the position that a coach can take.
Okay.
But you can make them feel safe. A coach actually has a special place in a kid's life, right? They are somebody that's well-respected by the child. So the child is going to believe the coach normally. So the coach needs to be able to convey strength and that I got this, you got this, it feels uncomfortable, but man, I know I've seen kids go through this, or if they've had their own experience, that would be mm-hmm. marvelous. They could share that, but to just be that rock, so that the kid can know, I might feel like I'm falling apart right now, but coach says I'm okay. So let me believe that. So they have to have that good relationship as they would with a parent to believe. And the coach can actually tell them, you know, how to breathe. I think these are important things for teachers and coaches and anybody who works with children to know. If you see a kid starting to breathe fast, rapidly, and shallow, that you want to instruct them to do that belly breath. Let your belly relax.
Mm-hmm.
Let your ribs expand and take that deeper breath, because that is a physical message to the brain that everything's okay, because we can't breathe like that when we are in danger and running.
Right.
Or hiding and freezing, right? We can't breathe like that. We're like little shallow breaths so we don't get found, you know?
Right.
So have the coaches learn how to instruct the breath.
How can we support and manage, you know, on a daily basis when we're both first in a panic attack and then when we're managing the overall panic? What are some ways that someone can do to manage that?
Okay, that's a good question, because some of the things that you'll do for your long term are not going
right.
to help you in the short term, right? So I teach people how to meditate for the sake of the long term, right?
Okay.
A lot of people will write to me and they'll go, I listened to your show and then I meditated in my panic attack and it didn't help. And it was like, no, it won't help then. It won't help then.
Right.
So, you know, like the coach cannot say, okay, just study, take a 10-minute meditation break. But that is a long-term way of being able to access that parasympathetic nervous system again, because we're doing it on purpose, sitting and following like breadcrumbs right back to our inner heart again. And just that peace and calm that resides in every single one of us, but we forget our way there. So we can't find our way there in a panic.
Right.
We have to have practiced for a long, the more you practice, the more you're going to be able to remember how to go back there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing. And the breathing is another thing. So you can actually do the breathing with your meditation. The breathing you should do when you are in a panic though.
Okay.
When you're panicked, say you're in the grocery store, a lot of kids panic in the grocery store just like adults do. And you feel, oh my gosh, you feel like the sweat is coming. You want to run out of the store and leave the whole cart there behind you. You just can hold on to the cart and take 3 belly breaths. I call them Buddha belly breaths, where your belly is really relaxed so that your diaphragm can flatten. And when the diaphragm flattens, it stimulates the vagus nerve, which sends that message right to the brain. Oh, things are okay. We can stop sending out those stress hormones.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine how helpful that would be to a child that's in a competitive sport, maybe before a meet, before a competition. I can imagine how practicing that would directly benefit.
Absolutely. I could see them even doing it as a group.
Right. That would be great.
Awesome. What a great practice to, because how can we can perform so much better if we're not in fight or flight looking for the, you know, the shoe to drop, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. What other types of ways can parents and supporters of athletes, what are some other long-term, say, management outside of an immediate type of attack? What are some other anxiety management tools that you like?
Anything that can teach the child how to get back into their rest and digest parasympathetic nervous system again. That can be anything from petting a pet, petting a dog or a cat, singing helps, drinking cold water. If you're in, that's a acute situation, you can just drink some cold water or have some ice in your mouth. It can help somebody to pop out. Mm-hmm. But always staying hydrated as a regular thing. And athletes have a little extra problem with that, you know, needing to have even more. Being able to feel the good relationship with people. So that's where the coaches can really come in and pay attention to how they're relating to each child on that level of, am I helping them to feel safe and secure? So for the children to be able to learn that this too shall pass. You know,
what do you think about journaling? What's your have you found that to be effective in your practice?
Yes, and even for the littlest of the little, they can make their own little one by stapling the paper together and decorating a cover. And if they're having some feelings, to write them down.
Okay.
They can write them down, or they can draw them. Nothing like art therapy for the kids. Draw your feelings if you can't put the words down. I love journaling for the older children and the teenagers, because there's many things they don't want to say.
Right.
But they can put it in a journal. Yeah. Right.
What is your thought? Have you seen that long-term anxiety is managed by being outside, by movement? You know, we're talking about athletes that move for, you know, they move for a living. It's part of, but some of the non-competitive ways of movement, what would you say, what type of management, non-competitive movement would you recommend?
Yeah, I think that's especially important for the athlete, because they've equated probably a lot of their movement with competition. Mm. And so it carries a little bit more of a little heavier stress load on them. Okay. So being able to just find your joy in your body, that could be anything from, you know, I love yoga for that, because you can incorporate the breathing in that at the same time. It's almost, and the Tai Chi or Qigong warm-up, which is a little bit more free flow. But again, you're integrating the breathing with that, so that it's almost like doing your meditation, but moving. And then just being in nature, you know, take your shoes off and walk in the grass, go out in the woods, you know, get in the lake or the stream or the ocean. Water is awesome. And you know what? If you can't get out into nature for water, get in the shower or the tub. It really works wonders.
Right.
But
right.
In a way that's not just part of the old routine. You know, they have to break out and have it be more self-care and a little bit more like, this is for me. This feels good.
It sounds like you're saying also part of this managing the long-term anxiety is taking agency back and authority back over your body and your person, which, you know, we can speculate if you are competitive from a young age in sports, a lot of what you're doing with your body, you're being told to do by a coach, or make this correction, do this, move this way. This skill is going to advance your athletic career. But it sounds like what you're saying is that part of managing the long-term anxiety is having some of that agency back over your person. Am I understanding that correct?
Absolutely. And I'm, you know, it's sad to watch it be taken away from children. So I think maybe there is probably more of a movement nowadays to not have that happen so much. But especially the younger ones, no one is advocating for them, right? As far as this is yours. Do you even want to do this? Like, you know, it can feel like the right thing at one moment, but maybe not another year down the road. So just being able for them to be able to keep that connection of, I'm in here, this is my body, and do I like this? Do I want to do this?
Mm-hmm.
Does that feel right to me? Does it feel right to me to eat like that or to move like that?
Mm-hmm.
To be adjusted like that or whatever the thing. Mm. And I think that's a place where parents can be really helpful in instilling that into the children, that this is wonderful and great and you're really good at this, but how does it feel for you? What does it feel like? Yeah.
Right.
We have to stay connected. We're very unconnected.
Staying connected. Staying connected. I feel like that is the way back. That's the way back to the natural state, staying connected. Gina, thank you so much for this, you know, having learned, seeing the scenarios of when we can get out of our natural state and what that brings about, whether it looks like an eating disorder, whether it looks like the rapid breathing, whether it looks like a full-blown panic attack in the different iterations, whether it looks like anger. I'm glad that you were here to share with us some of those long-term tips, as well as when you see your athlete or your child in the throes of a panic attack, you know, to follow their lead. So that's what we're going to do. Will you please, let's end with just telling, where can people find you and your beautiful practice as the anxiety coach if people want to reach out to you directly?
Oh, sure. It's easy enough. It's just anxietycoachespodcast.com. Everything's on there. And You can find the show on any of your favorite podcast player, the Anxiety Coaches podcast. Yeah, the easy way to find us. Yeah. Happy to talk to anybody who has questions. Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you so much for sharing your time and your wisdom and ways to manage anxiety in ourselves as parents and young adults and competitive athletes. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Judy. Aloha.
Thank you for listening to the Legally Brief podcast. Remember to join Judy and fellow listeners at the Legally Brief Facebook group.